NPR is doing its annual survey to better understand how listeners like you spend time with podcasts. So please help us out by completing a short anonymous survey at npr.org/podcastsurvey. It's all one word. We would really appreciate your help to support NPR podcasts. Again, that is npr.org/podcastsurvey. All one word. Thanks.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix.
And I'm Celeste Headley in Washington, D.C. It's Here and Now. The Justice Department has brought seditious conspiracy charges against four members of the Proud Boys and the group's leader, Enrique Tarrio. The indictment is related to their role in the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021. In a statement, the DOJ said Tarrio and the other defendants, quote, conspired to prevent, hinder, and delay the certification of the Electoral College vote and to oppose by force the authority of the government of the United States, end quote. Sedition charges are historically rare. So why is the Justice Department bringing them out now? We'll talk about that as Tess Owen. She's senior reporter at Vice covering extremism. Hi, Tess.
Hi, Celeste. Thanks so much for having me.
So the Proud Boys are an exclusively male far-right organization. Can you give me a rundown of what they're alleged to have done on January 6th, 2021?
Sure. So the Proud Boys, they were founded in 2016. I called them a far-right street-fighting gang who were galvanized by the election of Donald Trump, seeking out street-level violence with political opponents known for misogyny, hipster racism. They've become sort of increasingly paramilitary over the years and wearing body armor to events and sometimes bringing knives or guns, as well as sort of cultivating ties on the fringes of the GOP. They're accused in this case of, in the run-up to January 6th, of basically planning the violent riot at the Capitol. And, you know, the government so far has provided sort of snippets of conversations, internal communications between some of the Proud Boys that does not look good for them.
Meaning that many defendants have claimed this was a spontaneous outburst of feeling that led to going to the Capitol. And you're saying the government has evidence, communication showing that it was planned.
That's correct. The indictment that was returned Monday indicates that the government believes that what happened that day was not just a spontaneous outburst of violence, but actually that the Proud Boys and another group, the Oath Keepers, were actually the architects of that chaos, that they conspired to incite an insurrection.
So Stuart Rhodes, who was the leader of the Oath Keepers that you mentioned, was previously charged with sedition. Can you tell us about the Oath Keepers? How similar are they to the Proud Boys?
Sure. So the Oath Keepers were founded in 2009 amid a sort of surge in anti-government ideology. They're the far-right anti-government militia network who have sought to recruit law enforcement and former military specifically. And their membership over the years has been estimated to be in the tens of thousands. In terms of their relationship with the Proud Boys, you know, I've reported on these groups a fair bit over the last few years, and I have seen some overlaps, especially as the Proud Boys became more paramilitary. They were sort of almost trying to fashion themselves into a militia-like group. And so, you know, occasionally I'd seen Oath Keepers at Proud Boy events. There were Oath Keepers who marched with the Proud Boys during a rally in December in D.C. in 2020. And as far as whether there were communication between those groups, we don't quite know yet, but prosecutors have mentioned a video that was taken on January 5th, 2021, in a parking garage in Washington, D.C., showing Enrique Tarrio actually meeting with Stuart Rhodes.
Mm. Okay, so as I mentioned, sedition charges are rare. They're quite serious. Do we know that if sedition was the goal of these groups, do we know much about their intentions?
The intentions, according to prosecutors, was to prevent the certification of the election results. And the idea is that the only day that they could certify the results was on that day. And so far, the internal chats that have surfaced, especially for these particular group of Proud Boys, there's five of them. One of them took a plea deal in April and agreed to testify against them. We know that these Proud Boys established a special chapter ahead of January 6th that was just devoted to planning that day. And Tarrio received a document called 1776 Returns, which set out a plan to occupy government buildings. In some of those chats, according to the prosecutors, they did mention storming the Capitol. And as the riot was ongoing, Tarrio, who was actually not there on that day, wrote, "Make no mistake, we did this."
Wow. Yeah, that's fairly clear. Tess Owen is senior reporter at Vice covering extremism. Tess, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
A heat wave will settle over the southwestern United States this week, soaring to 115 degrees or more here in the desert. The entire region is suffering through a long drought, and last week, some cities in California started restricting the use of water. People in LA can only water their lawns twice a week for a few minutes at a time. Here's the Metropolitan Water District's Adel Hajj Khalil at a recent press conference.
We are looking ahead and asking us to all work together, asking everyone to be ready to stretch the water we have so we all have enough water.
Let's bring in Stephanie Pincel. She's a professor with the Institute of the Environment and Sustainability at UCLA. And Stephanie, at this point, most of the new rules limit outdoor watering. Do you think that the authorities made the right call here?
At last. All the indications are that we are in a period where we are not getting a lot of rain. And whether you call that drought or simply a dry period, because we do live in the Southwest, the climate is changing and we have had these periods before, we have to manage the resources that we have for the most important uses, which are indoor water uses, washing, cooking, and so forth. The water that you use outside on your lawn, say, is the water you will not have to drink. And it's really down to managing your water in that way. So you have to have priorities. And I think water to drink is a lot more important than having lush, mesic landscapes that never belonged here in the first place.
And there have been water restrictions before in Southern California, but I understand these cuts are even deeper. Can you just describe, from what you can tell, how dire the region's water supply is? I mean, we see pictures of these reservoirs that are just incredibly low. What are you seeing?
Oh, I see the same thing. They are incredibly low. Actually, we have had in the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power territory these kinds of restrictions before. And I think that rather than whining about it, we should be happy to have our agencies looking out for our future.
Now, on the one hand, you're right. Some of this is ornamental. There are people who are complaining that their lawns are dying. But on the other hand, there are those who say that wildfire risk will get worse because dead or drying vegetation, especially around homes, can easily burn. Is that a concern?
I think that people find very clever ways to object to not being able to water their vegetation. If it's a high fire season, that vegetation is not going to be the barrier to the fire getting into your house.
Governor Newsom said that the state could impose mandatory water restrictions and a full outdoor watering ban across the state as soon as September. Do you think that is where California is heading?
Well, I think that it's not totally unlikely. The problem has been that in the past, people have responded to the calls for reducing outdoor water use much more aggressively than they have this past year. I think that part of the reason why people have not is because there was the recall and Governor Newsom played his cards pretty safe to avoid that recall and did not call on people to reduce their water use early enough. I think MWD had banked perhaps too much on the Colorado River. And the thing about water is that it is managed year to year. It's not something that is generally managed over a longer term period. So with a lot of uncertainty about precipitation, not that I think there was a lot of uncertainty, but some uncertainty, political tepidness because people don't like to be told they can't water their lawns, they were a little conservative in blowing the whistle about the urgency of this situation.
You know, well, there are several sources for water in Southern California. You mentioned one of them, the Colorado River. The largest share of the river goes to California. And while your state is aggressively mandating cuts to consumption, most cities in places like Arizona, where I live, they're going about business mostly as usual under the same dry conditions. Do you think that, I don't know, it's time for widespread action across the Western United States?
Yeah, I think so. I think that places like Las Vegas, places like Albuquerque are actually examples of how you address the potential of water shortage or living in a dry climate in ways that Phoenix, perhaps, and certainly the Southern California region have not. when you have the illusion of endless water because you've had good rains and we've had snowpack, in conditions where you don't have that, people are shocked because the whole system has been adapted to having water. You know, it's not even sufficient water. It's a profligate use of water.
Mm.
So we have to really rethink about what's important for humans relative to water that is necessary, sufficient, and will help us thrive.
Hmm. Stephanie Pincel is a professor with the Institute of the Environment and Sustainability at UCLA. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you for asking.
And you heard us talk about the Colorado River. Maybe you heard my recent trip to a key reservoir along the river, Lake Powell, getting so low, the ability to create hydropower has been imperiled. Well, I was just looking at the level of the lake today. It's just about 27% full, which is actually a few feet higher than it was when I went there a few weeks ago.
The Pentagon's top general is comparing Russian actions in Ukraine to the horrors that French citizens suffered under Nazi invasion during World War II. General Mark Milley spoke at an event yesterday marking the 78th anniversary of Allied troops landing on the beaches of Normandy. More than 9,000 U.S. troops are buried at the Normandy American Cemetery and Memorial, where he gave the speech.
The fight for Ukraine is about honoring these veterans of World War II. It's about maintaining the so-called global rules-based international order, the order that was established by the dead that are buried here at this cemetery.
A few months ago, when the war in Ukraine was just beginning, we reached 31-year-old Ukrainian business analyst turned soldier Dmytro Veselov. At the time, he was armed with a rifle, patrolling neighborhoods of Kyiv, where he and his wife lived. He's now a translator with the Ukrainian forces being trained near the southern port city of Odessa. Dmytro, welcome back.
Nice to hear you again.
And you as well. Obviously, your life has completely changed over recent months. Is this where you thought you might be right now?
Well, no. I thought my military life would be a lot more boring, I suggested, from what I know about wartime. But, like, I work as a translator with a lot of U.S. volunteers who have a lot of combat experience and share it with Ukrainian troops. So it's way better than expected.
Are you seeing combat?
Yeah, well, I've been to the front lines twice for some operations.
In early March, when we spoke to you, you said you were not afraid yet, that Russian logistics were terrible. And yet here we are. The war is still grinding on. There is heavy shelling of border towns especially. Are you afraid now?
Right now I'm not shelled, so not afraid. And when I was shelled and there were missiles, Russian missiles exploding over my head, yeah, that was a bit unsettling.
So Ukrainian troops in the town of Severodonetsk are said to be holding up against the Russian shelling. Another Russian general was killed in fighting yesterday. But up the river from Odessa, we're told that territory may fall to Russian troops. How is the morale among Ukrainian soldiers?
Well, the morale is high, so we're inflicting high casualties to the Russians because we're defending, and that helps. The world still helping with us as we run out of our equipment. The new equipment arrives, so that gives a senior morale boost to people. But, like, otherwise, well, it's hard, like, because we're fighting against an overwhelming force. Like, Russia still has, like, what, 5 times more artillery and 10 times more tanks at every place of the front.
So you're in relative safety now in Odessa. Give me an example of how a typical day goes for you.
Oh, it's a wake up 5:30 PT, then prepare for a day of training. Then I either run and translate for the classes for the soldiers or give out some training programs like the tactical medicine. And late evening, it's basically mostly communication with NGOs and solving logistical hurdles.
So long-range weapons are on their way. Ukrainian troops will get their hands on them soon. Obviously, the troops will need to be trained in how to use these weapons. But do you think that this will be a game changer for Ukrainian forces?
On paper, they're supposed to be, yeah, because like these are like multiple launchers of guided missiles, and Russians do not have those. So in theory, yes, but in practice, like we just need to see. Like it's not even the first battery of HIMARS have seen frontline action yet.
So you evacuated your wife and mother back in March. Are they still safe?
Yeah, they're already returning to Kyiv next week.
Really?
Yeah.
And you feel comfortable with that? You feel like it's safe enough for them to come back?
Yeah, safe enough. Well, I mean, I've been to Nikolaev, where like there are daily Russian missile strikes, and probably Kyiv is even safer, so it's good enough.
All right, so when do you think, how much longer do you think you will be working for the Ukrainian army? At what point do you think your life might start to get back to normal?
I mean, like, if the war is over and, like, the returning to my previous job as business analyst seems to be a better option than sticking with the military.
Which means you're not sure. This could be your life for the foreseeable future?
Maybe. Yeah, could be. Also, like, I may, like, just become one of the casualties of war. This is a reality for me every day, and it keeps in my head. So probably the foreseeable future will be sooner than it seems.
Well, I wish very much that that does not happen and that you remain safe. Dmytro Veselov is a business analyst, now a translator with the Ukrainian army. Dmytro, thank you so much.
Looking forward to hearing from you again.
If you are into cycling, you may know the name Marshall Major Taylor. He was a groundbreaking black cyclist, a champion who set records in the sport starting in the 1890s. He faced racism at nearly every turn. Today, dozens of bike clubs have formed in his honor to promote a more inclusive cycling community. KCUR's Luke Martin takes us for a ride with one group in Kansas City, Missouri.
Growing up, Mitchell Williams was taught that bikes were toys, and once you reached the age of 16, it was time to put down the kickstand and pick up a set of car keys.
When I was a kid, you'd ride a bicycle, and you get that feeling of going downhill, and the speed, and the rush, and that wee! I still get that wee experience now.
For a good portion of his life after he started driving, Mitchell Williams didn't really ride anymore. But by middle age, he says, he needed a lifestyle change.
All right, let's roll. Rolling.
After retiring from his financial services job, Williams eventually became the first African-American president of one of the metro's biggest bike nonprofits, called Cycling KC.
I did as much as I could to try to invite people of color and women to ride our club rides. It was difficult. I mean, they just weren't showing up.
So around 2014, he helped form the Major Taylor Cycling Club of Kansas City, one of more than 50 such clubs around the world. Williams' goal was simple: get more people of color in the saddle and make a positive impact on their health.
Hey guys, make sure we talk to each other. Call out road hazards. When you get ready to stop, let people know you're slowing. Let them know you're stopping. No accidents, okay?
Every Monday, between March and November, if the weather's good and the roads are dry, the Major Taylor Cycling Club of Kansas City hosts a group ride open to anyone with a bike and a helmet.
We're not the fastest club. I mean, we're not known for speed. We're not known for being on time. So why do people come? Because they like being with us.
Riding a bike is so relaxing, you know what I mean?
Ivy Brito, who moved to Missouri from Kentucky a couple years ago, says the group motivated her to ride further than she had before.
The most I rode in a year was like 160 miles. Last year I rode 889 miles with these people. So, yeah.
Denisha Snell joined the club after a years-long search for other black women to ride with and says the group's racial diversity isn't the only thing that's unique.
They may be professional cyclists, or you may have somebody who is a novice who is just starting out, right? And because of that, there's a space and a place for everyone.
That spirit of inclusion, she says, is part of why the group starts these rides in the heart of Kansas City's black community.
We want to be in certain areas, in certain neighborhoods. We want kids to be able to see us. We want folks to be able to see us that who maybe say black folks don't ride bikes, but we do. We're right here.
Major Taylor.
Yeah,
my name's not so bad.
Look us up on Facebook.
Yep.
Major Taylor, Kansas City.
Okay.
Yeah.
The inspiration for this club, Major Taylor the Man, was born and raised in Indianapolis and competed in cycling events around the globe in an era of strict racial segregation. By 1899, he was the world cycling champ, just the second black world champion in any sport. But black cyclists continue to face headwinds. Many across the country have been outspoken online about the discrimination they've faced within and outside of the cycling community. The Chicago Tribune found that more than half of the bike tickets issued in the Windy City in 2018 and 2019 were in majority black neighborhoods. Mitchell Williams says he's never had to deal with direct racism while cycling in Kansas City, but he takes another lesson from Taylor's legacy. Do your best and create community.
I like helping people to achieve their goals, seeing them become fulfilled, and that makes me happy. So that's why I do this.
For Here and Now, I'm Luke Martin.
Buy now, pay later plans have surged in popularity in recent years. More than half of all American consumers have used them. And now Apple has hopped on the bandwagon. Its new Apple Pay Later service will let customers buy products and then spread out payments into installments over time. But this easy access to credit that this model provides has raised concerns about potential risks for consumers, particularly young people. Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure, is following all of this. Hi, Robin.
Hi, Celeste.
Do you think it's significant that Apple is getting into the pay over time business?
I think it's dipping its toes into this business simply because the iPhone is such a center of gravity. It's such a global platform, not for just everything else that you do in your life, but transactions. If you have an iPhone, you also have Apple Store and iTunes, and they have your credit card number. So for them, it's just the convenience that they're extending to their users, especially their younger users and their merchants who are trying to stave off, you know, shopping cart abandonment. How do you consummate more of these online transactions? And this is thought of as a kind of a way to induce that.
And is Apple intending, I assume, to make money with the service?
I think they assume to make money on everything that they do. But having said that, their foray into the whole payments business has kind of been hesitating ever since Apple Pay has been around for 7 or 8 years. They still have a tiny sliver of everything, because to be wholeheartedly into this payments business, you have to assume the kind of the risk on your balance sheet. I think what they'd rather do is be a toll keeper or a facilitator and let the heavy lifting to the banks and the credit card companies.
But this is part of a landscape in which these pay later services or pay over time services are gaining in popularity. What are the potential risks for consumers here?
That it's stealth subprime. I mean, we remember with the consumer protection advocates after the financial scandals of 2008 and 2009 coming in there and saying, you took advantage of people with usurious credit, with mortgages that were kind of Alt-A liar loans. Of course, there was lying on both sides of that because people wanted the credit. But time was, Celeste, that college freshmen would show up and see their mailboxes filled with these too good to pass up credit card applications. And as you see all of that volume effectively go online, you have to, if you're a financial services company, be smart about that. If they're more skeptical about traditional credit cards, how do you get to them through something that is kind of usury light? You know, you're just splitting the cost. But if you read the fine print, you could get hit with a hefty penalty at the end and actually hurt your credit rating.
And speaking of college freshmen, young people in particular are racking up debt to buy things like shirts. and, you know, clothing. What are these special, the concerns for Gen Z and millennials?
And they're increasingly talking to the press, and you're seeing state regulators, banking regulators, and the FTC and the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau catch up with it, saying that, gosh, I thought it was great because there was this handbag and I could have it right now for $50 as opposed to the $300, right? They'll break it into payments. And they get that sticker shock either with the credit card statement or their credit rating slashed in several months. And so there's very much a caveat emptor thing happening. And as you know, Celeste, it's always been a game of cat and mouse with regulators and the industry.
Yeah. That's Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. As always, thanks, Robin.
Thank you, Celeste.
Owners of big cars and trucks may soon have to pay more for the privilege of driving them in the nation's capital. Washington, D.C. is considering an annual $500 registration fee for cars that weigh more than 3 tons. That's compared to $72 a year for a regular, typical sedan. Mary Che is the D.C. council member who proposed that idea, and she is here with us now to tell us more about it. Councilwoman, welcome.
Thank you.
And first of all, why don't we nail down what kind of vehicles you're after here? Anything over 6,000 pounds? What is that?
Yes, anything over 6,000 pounds or greater, and that would be your, you know, Hummers and big trucks and that sort of thing. Most will have no change and still pay the $72 per year. And then there's a middle group from, say, 3,500 to just under 6,000 pounds that will have an increase of $60 and $95 respectively. It's only those that are 6,000 pounds or greater that will go to $500. And that will be a $345 increase.
Now, you're in a big, crowded city like Washington, D.C. Do you see a lot of those vehicles on the road?
Actually, the number is not all that great. I don't know precisely what it is, but I do know this. I know that those heavy vehicles cause great harms in a number of ways. First, they're really hard on our roads, and also they use more gasoline. And what's really bad about them is that they're more dangerous. You're 2 to 3 times more likely to die if you're hit by one of these large vehicles than if you're hit by another vehicle. Of course, speed has something to do with that, but in general, that would be the difference. So it's a way, although it's not, you know, perfectly adjusted, it's a way for these larger vehicles to pay their fair share of the harms that they are causing. And by the way, we haven't changed our registration fees since 2003. And during that time, the size of vehicles has increased enormously. So it's to bring it proportionately to the harms that are caused by these larger vehicles.
Now, on the one hand, I could, I mean, what you're saying makes sense. There's a lot of reasons why you could or should do this. But wouldn't you be better off making significant changes to the infrastructure of the city, adding, I don't know, protected bike lanes, for example, than regulating what people drive?
Well, we're not regulating what people drive as such. What we're saying is if you're driving these big, heavy vehicles and causing these harms, and could there be other things? Well, we're also doing other things. And let me just say, as a what I think an elegant part of this bill, is that unlike most motor vehicle registration fees that go into our general fund, the money from this will go into protecting the safety of children around schools. And so I think it's a nice way to take the very money that may be generated from this and use it to make the school areas safer for our children.
And how much do you think that might be? How much could you raise?
Well, in 2023, because I think it won't go into effect until October, it's going to be $2.3 million. But then thereafter, for example, in 2024, it'll be $9.3, I think it is, a little bit over $9 million. So it's not, you know, it's not insignificant.
Yeah. I, you probably remember last year when President Biden visited a GM factory in Michigan and drove an electric Hummer, which was very large. It's a very heavy vehicle, 9,000 pounds, although it is electric. So, you know, that would take care of the environmental issues. But do you think sort of big picture that there's really much of an appetite in this country that loves its big cars and its big trucks to make a shift to something smaller?
Well, people do seem to love these larger vehicles, but, and this is not necessarily, I don't have any illusions that this is going to be, you know, very significant calculation about what one buys. The most important thing that has to do with this, it seems, is the cost of gasoline. That's going to have more of an effect on people in general. But again, even if it doesn't change buying practices, at least it makes those who buy these very, very large vehicles pay for the harms, the additional harms that they are causing. I don't believe that people are going to sit down and say, I'll say, oh, honey, should we get that Hummer? And they go, well, you know, the registration fee just went up $300 and some. I don't think that that's going to factor into it per se. But I do think by having that extra money from the registration fees, we can, first of all, increase safety around our schools, but also as a matter of proportionality and fairness, instead of all of us taxpayers paying for the harms caused by these larger vehicles, let the people who want them pay for it.
All right. Mary Che is a member of the Washington, D.C. City Council. Councilwoman, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Most state borders in the U.S. are pretty clear and indisputable, but the line between Michigan and Indiana is anything but clear, and it has been unsettled for decades. Jacob Lazaro of member station WVPE explains why this is the case and what's being done about it.
Michigan borders three states, Indiana, Wisconsin, and Ohio, and that Ohio border has been the most controversial by far. In 1835, the two sides nearly went to war for control over the Toledo Strip. And one century later, Michigan and Wisconsin went to the Supreme Court to settle a border dispute in the Upper Peninsula. But the Michigan-Indiana border is different.
I called it the quiet border because nothing ever comes up.
That's Jack Owens, a semi-retired surveyor who's been advocating for a modern retracing of the border for 20 years now. He says because of those past controversies, Michigan's Ohio and Wisconsin borders were resurveyed in the early 20th century and staked with durable markers of concrete or stone. In contrast, the Indiana border has not. It was last surveyed in 1827. The team placed wooden posts every mile to mark the border, recording the locations using two reference trees and any notable topographic features like lakes or streams. But those posts have long since rotted away, leaving the state border unclear.
Everybody's got an idea where it is. It's just, you know, if you had to know exactly, you know, we can't tell you.
Jack Owens took up the issue 20 years ago when he gathered a group of surveyors. One of them, John Comer, says one of the reasons a modern border survey is needed is because surveyors in 1827 were limited by equipment and the terrain. To illustrate that, he pulls out a record of an 1885 survey done to determine property lines on some land near Lake Michigan. While not along the state border, County Surveyor Albert Drew still went through quite a lot, battling 25-foot-deep sand drifts and rough terrain thickly filled with trees.
And therefore, I depended entirely upon the needle for my course, which would have been his staff compass. What he should have been doing is perpetuating, kind of leapfrogging that line along, but he couldn't see back from one to the other to push it forward.
In the notes, Drew also offered some advice for future surveyors.
And then he says, if it ever becomes necessary to resurvey this section, let me advise the man who undertakes it to get his life insured.
John Comer says since most of the original markers are gone, a new survey can only be done through the Supreme Court or the respective state legislatures. So they began lobbying. And their efforts paid off. Indiana approved legislation to create a state boundary commission in 2009, and Michigan followed suit in 2011. But Comer says funding for the surveys never got off the ground, and the commissions eventually dissolved. Now, there's a renewed push. Last month, Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer reestablished her state's border commission. Indiana did the same thing 3 years ago. Using a mix of technology like GPS, along with the 1827 notes, the survey will look for the locations of the original markers and set permanent mileposts to give an exact picture of where the border is. But when it's all said and done, any potential differences will not be massive. In places where the border is off, it's likely only by a few feet or a few inches. Most likely not entire houses and definitely not whole towns. So why even bother doing this?
When it's your line, and especially if there's a problem, then it's very important. I mean, when I was doing a lot of private practice, people would come in and fight over inches.
And even if it's just a few inches, Commerce says people should care about a properly surveyed state border, as a matter of state sovereignty. For NPR News, I'm Jacob Lazzaro.
The Biden administration is trying to shift the country away from fossil fuels, and so yesterday it announced that solar panel imports will be allowed from Cambodia, Malaysia, Vietnam, and Thailand for 2 years without the threat of tariffs. There was pressure from the domestic solar industry, which needs more panels for installation. Let's bring in Evan Halper, energy reporter at The Washington Post. Evan, good to speak with you.
Good to be here, Peter.
And first, we need you to help us understand. The Commerce Department is investigating China, trying to funnel cheap solar panels through these other countries. And up until this week, there had been this threat of tariffs on any panels that didn't comply with the trade rules. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, that's exactly right. This investigation started on April 1st. And the big thing that's sort of screwing up the solar market with this investigation was that the tariffs could be retroactive. And so if the Commerce Department ultimately found after a months-long investigation that there was what they call circumvention going on, that China was just kind of using those other countries as a conduit where they were just kind of putting a few screws on the panels, but most of the materials were coming from China, and that would be illegal under U.S. trade laws. There was threats of tariffs of, you know, anywhere from 50% to 250% on these panels, and it just froze the whole market.
And so when you say it was messing up the market, what does that mean exactly? What was going on?
Well, it means you couldn't get, if you're an installer or a developer of a big solar project, a utility scale solar project, say a solar farm that's going to connect to the grid and provide a large amount of energy, you couldn't get panels. And so we were seeing all kinds of projects get canceled or delayed. Literally hundreds of projects were thrown off track because there was so much concern about what would happen if these tariffs were ultimately decided. The Commerce Department ultimately decided these tariffs were necessary, and then everyone would have to pay them retroactively. And so, a lot of the panels were coming from these countries, and the market just froze.
So that would help explain why the Biden administration, which is trying to promote clean energy, is allowing these imports without the threat of tariff. But what kind of impact do you think it might have now on the solar industry? Does it clear the way for these projects?
I talked to several representatives from the solar industry yesterday, and there was a lot of optimism that projects that were stalled will be getting back on track very quickly. The panels are still being made in these countries. They just weren't getting sent to the U.S. because there was so much concern about what these tariffs would mean. So in terms of stalled projects, many of them will probably get back on track. And, you know, this did create a lot of paralysis in the renewables market for a couple of months. But there's optimism that, that'll quickly sort itself out and things will resume. But the bigger issues about where these panels are coming from, and if there is this quote unquote circumvention going on, and if U.S. trade law is being followed or not being followed, you know, Commerce is still investigating that, and it does raise questions about like how much teeth there are in U.S. trade law if they're willing to give this reprieve.
Well, exactly. So, what kind of statement does this send to China?
It sends a real mixed statement. It sends a mixed statement to China. It sends a mixed statement to, manufacturers in the U.S. about, how strongly the administration is going to get behind them. I mean, this really created a conundrum for the Biden administration because they have these very aggressive clean energy goals, and there was no question that the, inability to get these panels into the U.S. was jeopardizing those goals. On the other hand, they're also trying to prop up a domestic panel manufacturing industry, and this whole scenario just showed how difficult it is and, how far behind the U.S. is in getting that domestic industry that's sort of, that supply chain that's crucial to a renewable energy future up and running.
Let's be clear what you're talking about here. There's two sort of components to this domestic industry. On the one hand, the companies that install the solar panels, they're happy about this because they now have more supply. And then the companies that manufacture the solar panels here in the United States who now have more competition. So how are they reacting to this decision?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, this whole issue created a rift in the solar industry. The installers and the developers who just wanted to get these projects up and running and up online, they were pressuring the Biden administration heavily to give them some kind of protection from these tariffs. On the other hand, the people who make the panels, you know, the small number of companies that make the panels in the U.S. are saying, you know, what are you doing? There's violations of trade law going on, or we believe there's violations of trade law going on. And, you know, if you're going to protect these Chinese firms who are just blatantly, brazenly violating the trade law, as, you know, as the U.S. manufacturers allege, then what kind of signal is that sending to U.S. manufacturers?
Hmm. Energy reporter Evan Halper with The Washington Post. Evan, thank you so much for your input on this. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on, Peter.
And just a reminder, NPR is doing its annual survey to better understand how listeners like you spend time with podcasts. So please help us out by completing a short anonymous survey at npr.org/podcast survey. It's all one word. We would really appreciate your help to support NPR podcasts. Again, that is npr.org/podcast survey, all one word. Thanks.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix.
And I'm Celeste Headley in Washington. It's Here and Now.